how you can favor fish over people is something that people in my part of the world would never understand.
There are pumps that pump the water down here, and those pumps also kill the Delta smelt.
This really is a case of environmentalism and government being put above the well-being of people.
At some point, the reckoning comes. And the question is, will that reckoning, will that realization come in time to save one of the great natural cornucopias, one of the great natural estuarine ecosystems on the face of the earth?
Well, California's drought has gotten the attention of Washington. President Barack Obama is scheduled to arrive in Fresno this afternoon to take a look at California's devastating drought. He'll meet with local farmers and announce more than $160 million in federal aid. The Central Valley is where a third of America's produce is grown, and it's been one of the areas hardest hit by the dry weather. For a close-up look now of how people there are adjusting to this new reality, we're joined by Bill Diedrich. He's a fourth-generation farmer who grows a variety of crops around the Fresno area. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you very much, Madeline. Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure. What do you grow there, and which of your crops uses the most water?
Well, we're a diversified farm. We grow row crops and permanent crops. Almonds are probably our biggest crop and probably our biggest water user also. But it is also the most profitable crop. But we grow processing tomatoes, so we grow the tomatoes that go in your ketchup and your tomato paste and your stewed tomatoes and various other crops, walnuts, grapes, cotton, alfalfa, wheat, pomegranates. We're very well diversified.
So tell us how the drought has affected your operation there.
Well, the immediate drought, the hydrology, has forced us to fallow land, and that's going to be reducing our production, our agricultural output. We've had to fallow land to garner water enough for the ground that to grow the crops we can grow. So basically, we're shutting down half of our production in order to maintain what production we can with the water we have. And that devastates the surrounding community and also affects our operations.
Half of your production. So what is that in terms of dollars?
Oh, probably for a small grower like myself, we're probably talking about $2 million worth of sales that's going to be eliminated from our operation.
Wow, that seems like a lot. And so that also means that you'll be laying off workers?
Yes. Obviously, we're not going to have the same workforce that we have, and we're not going to be able to purchase the same supplies we normally purchase. We've got, you know, everybody in the community suffers because I'm purchasing less inputs for my crops. The problem in California is we just don't have enough storage for the way that we're operating our system these days. Because if we're going to give the water, as much water to the environment as we give, we need to have more storage so there's enough water to maintain the agricultural production that we have. We've got an incredible asset in California, the Central Valley, the coastal region, even down in Southern California, there's a tremendous amount of agricultural production that's suffering. It's being throttled back because of the lack of water.
So about 80% of the state's water goes to farms, right, to farming and agriculture?
I don't like that number. I don't like that 80% number because it doesn't account for the water that's going to the environment. If you account for all water that's gathered in this state, these projects were put together to irrigate the arid soil of the West. The Reclamation's mission was to irrigate the arid soils of the West and bring about agricultural production. They were tremendously successful. Recently, in the last 20 years, we began to dedicate more of that water through legislation to the environment, which is fine. But that means we have to store more water, so we have more water for the environment, and we're able to maintain our agricultural production. I think ag uses closer to 45% of the water in the state based on total outflows. The 80% number is a number that people like to use. I prefer the 45% number because that allows for the 35% or so that's being released for environmental purposes.
Okay, so whatever the number, you guys are still, I mean, you are suffering. You're in an extreme drought situation. The president is there. Senators are there. The governor is there today, all talking about how they can help you. There's a $160 million program the president is announcing. What do you think of that? Is that enough?
I don't think that there's a grower in the valley that wants money. The people here want to work. I mean, I appreciate the efforts and the financial comfort that they're trying to bring, but what we want is we want this operation of the system to go back to the way it was, or we want more storage so that they can maintain the use of the water that we have today and continue to have production. Because all we want to do is farm. All the people that work for me, they just want to work. They don't want to have or feel like they're getting handouts. They don't want to stand in the food line.
Hmm. Have you talked to other farmers about changing the crops that you grow or changing your operations significantly?
Oh, yeah. We changed our operations immensely in the last 15 years. We have various associations that try and educate the public on what we're doing with our water. We'd love to bring people to the ranch, show them our drip irrigation, show them our the irrigation systems that we use today, the technology we use, the computer controls, the weather stations we have. The technology today is incredible to what it was 20 years ago, because the reliability of water has become such that we've had to do it. And it's been a good change. It increases production. We get more production per gallon of water today than we ever have.
You're a fourth-generation farmer, and I'm wondering, have you ever seen anything like this?
No, never. We've had droughts before. From 89 to 92, 93, we had a tremendous extended drought that we survived in a relatively, with less impact than this drought. This drought is going to take out permanent crops. We're going to lose almond orchards. There's going to be, permanent damage done to infrastructure because of the lack of water that may be very difficult to regain.
All right, Bill Diederich, thank you so much for explaining that to us down here in Southern California.
Really, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it. Anytime.
All right. Bill Diederich, a farmer up in Fresno. And let's now talk about how long this drought could possibly last. The answer, really, no one knows. But one researcher says it could last a very long time, decades possibly. Lynn Ingram is a paleoclimatologist at UC Berkeley and co-author of the book The West Without Water, What Past Floods, Droughts, and Other Climatic Clues Tell Us About Tomorrow. Welcome to the program.
Oh, welcome. Thank you.
Well, decades, really?
Well, yes. If we look back in the history of our climate over the past few thousand years, we see that multi-year droughts, many extending over a decade, occurred every 30 to 90 years or so in the past. So really, the 20th century was a relatively mild and stable century. That's a time when we developed all of our agriculture and our water development, our dams and canals. You know, we kind of come to expect that sort of stability with only two multi-year droughts lasting 6 years. And so we expect that we could go into a drier period in the future based on what the climate has done in the past.
How do you research that?
So what we do, because there were humans, but they weren't documenting these things. So we have to look in the natural climate archives. These are sediments accumulating beneath lakes, beneath San Francisco Bay and Delta, and the coastal ocean, as well as the tree ring records, that looking at the width of tree growth or tree rings, which is related to how much rainfall or precipitation there has been that year.
And so by looking at that, you can see patterns from not only the past 100 years, but for a lot longer than that. You wrote a recent article for the LA Times saying that the year 1580 stands out as the driest year. Talk about that.
So that comes from the tree ring records. And so looking at trees from throughout the West and the giant sequoia from the Sierra Nevada, So this was a dendroclimatologist who studied trees. I personally study sediment cores. But they have looked at tree rings over the past 500 or 600 years and seen that the narrowest ring occurred during 1580. In some places, the giant sequoia had no ring. So it was so incredibly dry that they just didn't grow at all that year.
And so are you saying that that could happen now, we could experience some kind of repeat of that?
Well, we could, because we're, at least so far this water year, we're extremely dry. So we're on track if it continues to be dry. We did have one, storm last weekend. But if we don't have any more of those storms, then we're on track for being similar to that year, which was similar to 1976-77, those really, really dry years. And then the big question, though, is what's going to happen the year after that and as we go forward, because surviving one year should be something we should be able to do. But if we have continued drought or continued lower than average precipitation, then, that starts to deplete our reservoirs and, we start to get into more and more trouble.
So is there any way to predict the length of droughts, or can you only look back? Can you only look back at the tree rings and the sediments and for the data in the past and guess? But is there a better way of actually predicting what could happen going forward?
There's not a way that I've heard of, but looking back at least gives us a sense of what the natural climate variability is in this region. And, we found that the climate, these kind of climate patterns tend to repeat themselves. And so, and then we see some cycles and we're expecting, to perhaps be going into a drier cycle. But it's kind of like predicting earthquakes where you can't, something is going to happen, but you can't say exactly when. And then the other thing is with climate warming, it's all of the models are showing that it's going to get drier in this region, and we've already seen evidence for drying in the region. I mean, it's already started over the last 4 decades. In terms of earlier onset of spring, the trends of decreasing snowpack, increased wildfires, and things like that. So, we're already kind of seeing the impacts of warming that will continue into the future.
Lynn Ingram is a paleoclimatologist at UC Berkeley and co-author of the book, The West Without Water, What Past Floods, Droughts, and Other Climatic Clues Tell Us About Tomorrow. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, how's the drought affecting you, and are you changing the way you use water in your daily life? You can let us know at our Twitter, at KCRW Press Play, or our Facebook page, KCRW's Press Play. Or you can leave us a voicemail. We might play it at the end of the show, 844-PRESS-PLAY, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, so we're talking movies, and today we have KCRW's own Kim Masters, host of The Business and editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter. Hi.
Hey.
And sitting next to her, Ben Fritz, who covers the business of Hollywood for The Wall Street Journal. Hi.
Hello.
So let's start with the big opening movie this weekend, and that is RoboCop.
The human element will always be present. Compassion, fear, instinct. They will always interfere with the system.
Dead or alive, you're coming with me.
Woo! Okay, should I go with him? What do you think?
It's a very quiet movie, as you can hear. It's very relaxing. But it's really interesting, there's a lot of remakes in Hollywood, as you know, and the studio MGM that made it, most of their business is taking their library and doing remakes. And RoboCop is it was a movie in the 80s that was sort of a warning about the politics of the future, this remake. by Brazilian director Jose Padilla is kind of about the politics of today and drones.
Oh, interesting.
And that's what he's trying to comment on. But the reviews have been very mixed. I think people who have fond memories of the original aren't liking this so much, and people who are taking it for what it is seem to be having more fun with it.
I really like the first one. Did you, Kim?
I can barely remember it. It was so long ago. I think this one's opening kind of on the soft side. So yeah. I don't know if it will be a big opening weekend for this film.
That's true. Although, in fairness, the snow on the East Coast is obviously killing the box office for pretty much everything right
also,
now.
Also, yes.
And it stars Joel Kinnaman, mm-hmm. who we
Who's
love
so
from
great
The Killing.
In The Killing, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a Swedish actor.
Yes. But he speaks an unaccented English.
That's right. And so is he trying to break out and become a big action star?
Well, yeah, I think the studio see him as the perfect kind of guy for a vehicle like this, which is that you need an actor who people have good feelings about, but isn't a movie star who's expensive. Uh-huh. And really the star of RoboCop is, of course, a RoboCop. But he's a good looking guy. And as evidence here, people have nice feelings about him. So he's sort of the perfect.
The ladies do.
He's a perfect casting for a remake.
Yeah, well, you know, we deal with a cluttered marketplace, although this is the time of year when you're not necessarily opening your greatest movie. This is a little bit of a fallow period.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
But you're looking, you know, a lot of the studios are looking for something recognizable of what they call IP, intellectual property, something where, you know, in this cluttered marketplace, people could at least say, oh, RoboCop, I sort of know what that is and I sort of get what that mm-hmm. is. And you don't have to have a lot of explanation.
And then maybe teenage boys will go.
Right.
And
going for those quadrants.
Quadrants, yes. Once again. The elusive quadrants. All right. So, Kim, you have an article out in The Hollywood Reporter this week about Noah, this new movie directed by Darren Aronofsky. And let's hear a little clip from the trailer.
Man corrupted his world and filled it with violence. So we must be destroyed.
A great flood is coming. We build a vessel to hold the innocent.
Mother! What's them?
This is a biblical movie?
It
sounds
yes,
like RoboCop.
A little bit. Well, if you think about what actually happens in the story of Noah in the Bible, a lot of people do not do well in that situation.
Right, right.
So that is the plot of this movie. What's interesting is Darren Aronofsky, he made Black Swan, which mm-hmm. grossed a lot of money, but he's generally kind of an indie-ish director, Requiem for a Dreamer, The Wrestler. So he's kind of an indie auteur sensibility, and he's married with a big budget, lots of effects in this film. And what you have in that situation is a studio doing what studios do. This is a movie that comes out in March, I should say. It stars Russell Crowe, and what Paramount Pictures wants to do is protect its investment. And so what they did was they started to test the unfinished film with audiences to, you know, without all the effects in place, without all the music in place. And for Darren Aronofsky, this is just horrible. This is an unfinished work. He doesn't think the audiences can envision what it will be like when it's finished. He has total confidence in his ability to bring this home in a way that will appeal to the faithful, the not so faithful, all different religions. And what happened when they tested the unfinished movie, there's this dark, angry Noah, and the scores were not so good, and the studio freaked out and started making its own cuts, which, for a person like Darren Aronofsky, total anathema.
So they freaked out because it was angering the religious crowd and they were afraid of an anti, like a bad PR campaign?
Yes, they're afraid it would come back, that Christians would boycott, you know, certain segments of the Christian audience. They say, as they put it, not the entire Christian audience, but a noisy subset of the Christian audience. You know, they're going after that huge audience that came to the Passion of the Christ, mm-hmm. drove it to over $600 million worldwide. Hollywood hasn't been able to find that sweet spot very often for that. And so that's what they wanted. And the fear is, the opposite happens, which is the Christians, certain segment of the Christians say they're not going to go, and maybe people who are not interested in the Bible also don't go. And instead of having all the quadrants, you maybe don't have any of the quadrants. That's the fear.
So he, from reading your article, this has been a passion of his for a long time.
Yes.
And he is not being, in his mind, sacrilegious.
Not at all.
Yet it's being interpreted as sacrilegious.
Yeah, he feels that he went, like, with the design of the ark. He says the Bible spells it out, and his production designer had all these great ideas about, let's make the ark like this or that. And he said, no. This is how it reads. It's like a box with three stories, and this is what it says, and we're going to use the measurements in the Bible. So he feels he's been completely respectful.
And what is it in particular that they don't like?
Oh, they have a lot of issues. First of all, I think it's that it's not the white-bearded, gentle shepherd Noah with them two by two. You know, he said that to Russell Crowe. You're not going to be like
Charlton
on
Heston.
A houseboat with two giraffes behind you, mm-hmm. right? And it's not going to be that. And then there's a lot of stuff where they, you know, he has... Some of it is actually in the Bible. For example, there's a scene where Noah gets drunk. which is in the Bible, as I am told, not a great scholar myself. And a lot of people have forgotten that that could have happened in the Bible. And therefore, when they see it, they respond. And there's also, I think, the central thing for this Noah is, does humanity deserve to live and continue on when they've already made such a mess of things on the planet? And he explores that in a way that I think people are finding, especially if they feel that this is supposed to be, you know, a very religious tale about how God chose the race to survive, the human race to survive. Noah questions whether humans should survive.
All right. So moving on to something a little less intellectual, shall we say?
Or not, maybe not.
Well, something a little fleshier of the flesh. Shia LaBeouf, who is starring in Lars von Trier's new movie, Nymphomaniac. A lot of people are scratching their heads at his behavior. And let's hear a clip from a recent press conference that where he was talking about the movie, or at least answering a question about the movie in a perplexing way.
When the seagulls follow the trawler, it is because they think sardines will be thrown into the sea. Thank you very much.
Okay, so people are clapping, I guess, or scratching their heads, and then he abandoned that press conference midway through. What is he doing?
It's very hard to say, but, you know, he is not the first actor who's had a lot of success very young, as he did in Transformers, who then has what some people might call a transformation, others might call a meltdown later yeah. on, right? And we see it with Brittany and Hannah Montana, I'm forgetting her name, and
Miley Cyrus,
of course, and on. They feel a strong need to transform who they are. And Shia LaBeouf, who, by the way, grew up, I think his mother's an artist, and he grew up on the east side of L.A., is a very sort of artistic upbringing and viewpoint, kind of hippie-ish. I mean, this seems to be his take on doing it, is to become a sort of alternative artist in the midst of the public.
Oh, so this isn't actually an art project?
One interpretation is this is all an art project, including the thing he's doing with the bag on his head.
Okay, well, let's talk about that, because he's got this installation where he is sitting at a table dressed up in a tuxedo, I guess, or a suit,
yes,
with a bag over his head.
Yes, and you can go on Beverly Boulevard and go in, and there are these implements you can pick, like there's a whip or a pink ukulele, or you can pick one, and then you can go into this little room, and you can sit opposite Shia LaBeouf while he has this bag on his head. I'm not sure how you absolutely know it's Shia LaBeouf, but people apparently feel that they are convinced that it is Shia LaBeouf, and he kind of looks at you. And if you ask him a question, according to the one account that I read, he doesn't necessarily answer, but he does seem to be crying a lot. Now, I mean, I would differentiate the meltdown. I mean, to me, Miley Cyrus is actually very strategic, and she's acting kind of crazy, but she's trying to break away from that Disneyfied image of Hannah Montana.
Yeah, it seems kind of calculated.
And it's pretty shrewd, I think, by most accounts, as opposed to, say, Justin Bieber, where he truly seems to be profoundly troubled. And what's unclear and ambiguous with Shia LaBeouf is which one of these, you know, these are all kind of riffs on plagiarism. He got into a thing where he had plagiarized some material, and then he proceeded to plagiarize a bunch of apologies for the plagiarism. And even this act is somewhat plagiaristic in its nature from a performance art piece that had been done by
Marina Abramovic.
Yes,
that's the one. It reminds me. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's been this kind of, you know, meta quality to it. Like, I'm plagiarizing, and then I'm plagiarizing the apologies, and now I'm sitting in a room with a bag. And that thing about sardines, that quote you just played, that was actually taken from a French soccer star who had said that, issued the statement when he was convicted of assault a few years ago. And so that's plagiarized.
Yeah.
So what is this? Is this somehow, I don't know what it's meant to be, and it's unclear.
So maybe he's plagiarizing Joaquin Phoenix.
Yes, it does seem like that's exactly
well put.
Kim Masters, host of KCRW's The Business, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter, and Ben Fritz reports on Hollywood for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Coming up on Press Play, the bizarre story of Japan's fake Beethoven, the man who composed the country's unofficial anthem to suffering and resilience, is a fraud. We'll go to Japan to find out how people are reacting there. First, though, we're going to take a little news break with KCRW's Steve Chiotakis.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, at the Olympics today, the men competed in figure skating, and I won't spoil it for you except to say that Japan's Daisuke Takahashi placed sixth. He was not expected to win, but he's interesting for another reason. Takahashi made the unfortunate choice of skating to the music of composer Mamoru Samurogochi, known as Japan's Beethoven, because his compositions are so beloved and because he's deaf. Here's his piece, Hiroshima, which has become an unofficial anthem in Japan. Well, it turns out Samurogochi is neither a composer of that piece or any other, nor is he deaf. Another man wrote his music, including this piece, and he came forward just before the Olympics began because he said he couldn't stand the deception any longer and didn't want it to stain the Olympics. Since then, every day brings something new. For example, it turns out the fake composer's mother-in-law knew something was off because she says he didn't have a piano in his home. Well, I talked earlier with Roland Keltz, author of the book Japan America, about this strange story. How is it that nobody unmasked him until now? How is he able to do this for so long?
That's part of the story, which is that the Japanese media is so conservative and so uptight and so afraid of breaking through press clubs. There are very tight press clubs here. And there's two parts to this story. One is that obviously some people knew and didn't talk about it. Capcom is a big gaming company, and they recorded his first work, which was for a very popular video game called Resident Evil, that is a global hit.
Yeah.
And there was a person who spoke off the record who said, "When we," I'm going to crack up, "when we would say his name behind his back, he turned his head," and everybody in the studio thought, "How did he know we said his name?"
And then they just brushed it aside.
Yeah. Yeah, because it was a great story, and he was selling CDs, right?
Yeah. So then it comes out because of the Olympics, because the original composer, the Cyrano, if you will, said, I can't take it anymore.
Right, Niigaki, a very nerdy, the Japanese use the term majime, a guy who's very committed to what he does and isn't at all flashy. He shows up at a press conference just before the Olympics saying, "I can't do this anymore." And he says this after he gave an interview to a tabloid that was coming out on the same day. And he says, "I can't do this anymore because we have Olympic hopefuls," specifically Takahashi, the figure skater, who's going to be performing to a piece of music that I wrote that is attributed to this phony. And I don't want this to happen on the world stage. In other words, it's gone too far.
Yeah.
And he says, I have to come out and say this. So it's on Japanese television live. It's like a press conference with the prime minister. Every television show cuts away to this guy who's got big glasses, a very skinny guy sitting there saying, "I've actually written all of this music for 18 years.
My gosh.
18 years, Madeline.
And it's not just any music. This song or this composition is considered like the national anthem of Japan, the unofficial national anthem.
Not the one at the Olympics. That is a sonatina that he wrote. But the bigger picture is that he wrote a symphony called Hiroshima Symphony No. 1. Now, the phony Beethoven, Samurogochi, is from Hiroshima. He has said he's a hibakusha, which is a survivor of the atomic bomb. Now, he wasn't specifically a survivor. His parents were.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very sentimental note in Japan, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And it was featured in a documentary about the disaster in Tohoku, the earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear disasters that happened 3 years ago. And so it was this symphony was played during a documentary on NHK, which is the BBC of Japan. And he went up to Tohoku, the fake Beethoven, to meet with victims, and he was teary-eyed, and he was crying, and this theme song, Hiroshima Symphony No. 1, was played in the background. So it became a theme song for the suffering of Japanese victims of Hiroshima and victims of the earthquake and tsunami. So what's happened recently, and this piece of music, incidentally, was performed by the New York Children's Choir when they came in July of last year, and they were set to perform it in March of this year.
Oh, my gosh. So what is the reaction in Japan? I mean, people just must be in a state of shock.
Some people are. There is a great deal of hurt. The figure skater in question has said that he had no idea that this guy was a fraud, and he couldn't re-choreograph his routine in time. So he skated to it last night, and may skate to it again today. There is another angle to this story, which is that the mainstream Japanese media has been under suspicion, especially after the disasters of 2011, because they were so slow to use the word meltdown. When media in the West were very openly saying there was a meltdown at Fukushima.
The nuclear power plant.
At the nuclear power plant, the Japanese media wasn't using the word, and they were kind of kowtowing to the governments. It kind of has that disgusting stink to it. Like, oh, the tabloids picked this up. And in fact, this guy is now publicly stating that he might not be deaf. He didn't write this music. And he actually said in his letter, you know, if my wife wants to divorce me, I'll accept that. I mean, he's sort of like spilling, you know, spilling his intestines out into the public. And I think there's also a sense of embarrassment that he's handling it so badly. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, what is what about Nigaki, the guy who actually composed the music? Like, is he being elevated at all as possibly a replacement hero for Japan?
Well, not yet. And I think I think there is a cultural issue at stake, which is that I think some people are not angry with him, but embarrassed at the way he confessed. Because some people have said, well, the compositions of this phony were used to elicit sympathy for the victims of Tohoku, of an earthquake and tsunami and meltdown. So why didn't you say something then? Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, is it really all about figure skating and the Olympics?
And so then people are thinking, well, maybe he wants a slice of the celebrity and he's more interested in that.
Yeah, either he wants a slice of the celebrity, or did you just have a bitching breakup with your with your you know, your beard? I mean, did something happen that you just said, all right, that's it, I'm coming out with it?
Well, was he getting paid?
Yeah, very little. He claims that what he made over the 18 years of these compositions is the U.S. equivalent of $70,000.
So not much.
Not much at all. And he's his official job, he's like an adjunct professor at a music college.
Roland Keltz, author, really is the author. He didn't go. He wasn't ghostwritten of Japan America.
I can hear. I can hear.
You can hear. Roland is a cultural observer, writer based in Tokyo and sometimes New York as well. Roland, thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline. I'm so happy to be on your new show.
All right, moving on to other Olympics news. All the luge events in Sochi are over. The Germans have been unbeatable. They won every available gold medal. But one of the biggest luge stories didn't take place on the track at all. It was Kate Hansen from La Cañada Flint Ridge warming up by dancing to Beyoncé. Videos of her dance went viral. Not everyone approved. Here is NBC commentator and ex-luger Duncan Kennedy watching Kate warm up before one of her runs.
Well, and I'll explain to you a little bit of what I meant by her warm-up, Lee. I would like to see something a little more sports-specific from her. What you see out of the top runners, the really heavy hitters, is they're working those start muscles. They're working the low back. They're working the arms and the shoulders and getting the power out of them, because the start has to be a powerful, explosive movement. And while that may be a very good general warm-up, I'm not sure it gets the job done.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, Kate Hansen is here now. Hi, Kate.
Hey.
I mean, first of all, what did you think of what he said? And what did you think about the fact that your private warm-up routine went so public?
You know, honestly, the guy who's announcing, we go way back. He was one of my first coaches growing up. So honestly, didn't think too much about it. And I mean, sometimes he says stuff like that. But, you know, maybe I'll just give him a little fans lesson myself, but you know, honestly, it didn't faze me at all. And, you know, he's just looking out for me.
Yeah. Well, did you agree with him that maybe it wasn't the best warm up or not?
You know, personally, that's what works for me.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the season, I broke my foot, and so I wasn't able to warm up properly. So I couldn't really run. I couldn't do body squats really. So, but what I could do was dance, and so it stemmed from that a little bit. And I mean, I just kind of ran with it, and it's worked, and I'll probably stick with it for a good while.
Well, you got some, a lot of attention also from Beyonce. So what did you think of that? All the attention for that rather than the actual competition?
You know, honestly, during racing, I turned off all social media. I didn't have my phone on or my computer. So it wasn't really aware of how big it got until, you know, I turned everything on after the race. And I mean, I honestly just think it's kind of funny. I mean, I definitely don't warm up that way for this attention. It's just kind of what makes me happy and what makes me ready to slide. But and honestly, the shout out from Beyonce was a dream come true. So I mean, it's been pretty cool. But I also think it's pretty funny how it's all turned out.
I know, it is pretty funny. Well, it's a good thing you're a good dancer, too. I'll just say that. And you're also a great athlete. And you said last time we were talking on your way to Sochi that you'd be happy with a top 10 finish. And indeed, you placed 10th. So are you satisfied?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's really just what I came into the game looking for, especially for my first game. I'm more or less just more stoked for my teammate, Erin Hamlin. She got a bronze. And that is the first time that's ever happened for a woman's luge, so really excited for her. But I mean, as far as I go, I did the best that I could, and I'm pretty happy about it.
Okay, so what now? You're done, and what's going on right now for you in Sochi?
So I'll go home for a little bit, and then I'll be back in school for my spring term up at Brigham Young University and get back to the books. But anything past that, you know, I haven't really planned yet, so I'm just trying to keep my options open.
So you're 21. Are you thinking 4 years, South Korea?
You know, we'll have to see. I can't say for sure. Gotta evaluate my life and what I want to do. And I mean, maybe it's a possibility, maybe it's not, but I'll definitely have to make some decisions coming up.
So are you, and you hanging out with the other athletes right now? Because it's nighttime there in Sochi.
Yeah, so we are pretty friendly. We hang out a lot. There's a USA lounge that we usually all go to go watch other people's events. So it's definitely been a lot of fun with the camaraderie.
Yeah, right. You guys are you caught up in that whole Tinder thing or not?
You know, that's not really me, but today I actually did post a picture on Instagram. And I mentioned Tinder, but it was a joke. I mean, some people got it, some people didn't. But I will confirm for you that it definitely does happen in the athlete village.
So we have heard. Well, have a good time, and maybe we'll see you in 4 years.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. That's Kate Hansen. She placed 10th in the luge, and she's originally from La Cañada, Flint Ridge. OK, Okay, that's my Valentine to you and to you, Warren Olney. Hi.
Thank you. I love you, too. We're going to talk today, remember Target? We're going to talk about credit card and debit card security. It turns out it's not what it might be, to say the very least. We're going to update that story with somebody from the FBI who's now in a private security firm. We'll also talk with the bankers and with the consumers union people about what they think the federal government ought to do, which is quite a lot at this point.
Excellent. Okay, that's coming up in about 15 minutes from now, 1 o'clock. Warren Olney and To the Point. Coming up on this program, Jamzilla begins tonight. We'll talk about that and other car news, including a push by the feds to make cars self-aware. Now that's coming up next on Press Play.
Check out our new YouTube video channel, The Q. KCRW DJs curate themed video playlists and feature artist clips straight from YouTube. Add some visual to your audio. Explore now at kcrw.com/theq.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, Los Angeles transportation officials are calling it Jamzilla, and you can call it whatever you want, but you definitely want to avoid the 405 this weekend. From tonight around 10 p.m. through Tuesday morning, workers will shut down most of the northbound lanes through the Sepulveda Pass. Officials are urging drivers to really stay away from that entire area. And that really sounds like pretty good advice. We're going to talk about that and some other car news now with our regular car guy, Matt DeBord. He's an auto journalist and he teaches business journalism at USC. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Madeline.
Okay, Jamzilla. What do we know about this?
Jamzilla. What a great name. They are going to shut down most of the 405, the northbound lanes, not the southbound lanes, over the weekend. Some of the lanes are going to be open during daytime hours, two of the lanes. The whole thing is going to be shut down at night. So the advice is, avoid the 405
stay
at all
away,
costs.
Stay away, stay
yes. away. So fear the 405.
I remember Carmageddon from a couple of years ago, and people were really scared. They did stay away, and it turned out to be great.
People were terrified.
Yeah.
They were scared to death. They really did a great job of scaring the living bejesus out of us here in Los Angeles by using this term Carmageddon. And then we had Carmageddon 2, and they both really weren't that bad.
So now is it going to be like the boy who cried wolf and... We're not going to believe it's that bad, and then it will be even worse.
This is my theory, you know, is that they had Carmageddon 1, Carmageddon the sequel, Carmageddon 2. You'd think Carmageddon 3, right? Except
yeah.
that Carmageddon just wasn't that scary.
So that's why they're amping up the name.
They're going with Jamzilla now.
So is it worth it? Are they the improvements that they're doing? I think they're repaving a lane and a carpool lane, right? An extra
Correct.
Lane.
Yeah, they're building a carpool lane, basically, is what they're doing.
So is this going to be worth it? Will it be easier after this is all done to drive on the 405?
Probably not, because what happens when they add capacity, which is the term that traffic engineers use for this stuff, people just fill up the capacity. So they're adding a carpool lane, which will limit, you know, the opportunity for some people to drive in that lane. And the idea is this will take some pressure off these massive traffic jams we have going up through the Sepulveda Pass with people trying to get between the west side of L.A. and the valley. But, you know, we just basically reached a situation in L.A. with our freeways where the existing freeways we have just don't have the capacity to handle all the traffic at peak times. So, you know, we're confronted with the prospect of having to build more freeways, and nobody really wants to do that.
No, no. It just seems like it's constant Jamzilla anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, in other car-related news this week, Toyota recalling under about 2 million of the latest Prius.
Right, yeah.
Is that something we should be afraid of?
Priuszilla. It's very Japanese. It's a Japanese car, right? You know, so it would be consistent. So this massive recall of these 2 million Prii is kind of an innocuous recall. There's an electronic glitch in the hybrid drive of the car that can cause it to stall under certain conditions. The circuitry gets too hot, the car goes into fail-safe mode, and it shuts down, and it won't let you drive the car anymore. And so far, there have been no accidents or problems associated with that Toyota knows about, but they've just undertaken this sort of unilaterally. And I think this is because Toyota is very contrite in the aftermath of their big recall problem with the unintended acceleration issues they had in 2010. So they're going right for the jugular, so to speak, and saying, we're just going to do it. We're going to recall it right away. And this is a complete change as far as Japanese automotive management history is concerned. Normally speaking, in Japan, you don't want to admit that you've done anything wrong until it's been aptly proven that you did something wrong. But Toyota's sort of learning the game a little bit better here.
This really underscores how complicated our cars are getting, all these computers in them. And now I think the government wants to make our cars even more sophisticated and install technology to make them talk to each other. Tell us about that.
Yes, the government wants to undertake a program. The National Highway Transportation Safety Administration wants to NHTSA, as it's sometimes called, wants to undertake a program where they're going to investigate whether we can have cars all aware of where they are on the road at the same time. Sort of a matrix of cars, if you will. And this is actually not as science fiction as it sounds. As we, you know, discussed already with the Prius, your car is essentially kind of a rolling computer now anyhow. There's lots of electronics and stuff in the vehicle that help you have a better driving experience. And Google has obviously gone made incredible advancements as far as the self-driving car is concerned. So we're not too far from having cars that are at least able to get around somewhat by themselves. So the next step is to make all the cars aware of where all the other cars are. And the idea is this will greatly increase safety because the cars will know if they're going to crash into another car. They'll know if they're too close. They'll know by using radars and things like that if a car is getting too close in another lane. The thing that bothers people about this a little bit is that it takes away the sort of mythology of the car as this conduit to personal freedom. Hmm. You can get in your car, you can go someplace. I mean, you probably have this experience all the time, right? You get in your car and you're in your car by yourself and you just think, man, I could just drive to Vegas now.
Right.
And I could pick up the phone when I get there and I could call my family and then they'd be, where have you been? Where are you? And you could say, I'm in Vegas,
man. You could say, I've been stuck on the 10 for 10 hours.
That's right. No. I've been on the 405 because I didn't listen to the advice about Jamzilla that I was given by the traffic lords, this weekend. So it takes away the whole idea of the car as this symbol of personal freedom. But on the other hand, 40,000 people are killed in car accidents on the roadways of America every year. And people, when they think about this, want to end this automotive slaughter that's happening in our midst. So it's probably only a matter of time. I mean, maybe, this pilot program that they're exploring of having cars be sort of aware of where all the other cars could be completed by the end of this decade. Things seem to be happening a lot faster than we ever thought they would in this area. So it's possible that in, 5 years or 10 years even, we won't really be driving our cars in the way that we've driven our cars in the past. We'll have the option of letting our cars sort of take us around. And inevitably, this will probably lead to a much safer driving situation.
Right, because tests have shown that driverless automated cars are safer than those piloted by error-prone humans who are likely to text or drink or whatever before they get behind the wheel.
Exactly. And we already have a bunch of other things that drive themselves now, so to speak. I mean, planes, pilots do fly the planes, but they're not flying. They're certainly the vast majority of the time that the passenger aircraft is in the air, the pilot's not flying it. A computer is flying it. Computers can actually land the plane if they have to in some situations. So the increasing computerization of cars, which are already pretty highly computerized, is something that's definitely on the horizon. It's just a question of how much sooner it happens than we think it will happen. Right. Unfortunately, the driverless car, one of the models that's probably going to be very preeminent as far as driverless cars are concerned is the Prius. Right. The Google driverless cars are Priuses for the most part. And we just had this big recall.
Oops.
Just because your car can drive itself doesn't mean it's not going to get recalled at some point. I think the interesting question for me is if it gets recalled, is it going to, get a signal from the mothership and then drive itself to the dealership? and get fixed and then drive itself back.
Well, thanks, Matt. Matt DeBord, auto journalist and just all around great guy. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
All around great gal, Jolie Myers is here now to share the mail.
Will you be my Valentine?
I will. I am yours.
We do have a lot of feedback today. A listener on our Facebook page wanted to talk about the drought, and she says she's got major water guilt. She sees the drought signs on the side of the road, and she's like, what can I do? And
don't we all?
Say
yes.
Yes, water guilt. Just total water guilt. She has a tip for us, though, and it's just in time for Valentine's Day. She says you should double up in the shower with your significant other. And she says, who knew water conservation could be so fun? Thanks for that tip. Just in time for Valentine's Day.
I just want to tell you, you can be my Valentine, but I'm taking a shower with you.
That's probably a good idea.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah. keep it clean. Send us your water saving tips. Press play at kcrw.com. You can tweet us at KCRW Press Play. We also got a couple of voicemails during the show for on our drought segment. I'm going to play the first one right now.
My name is Conrad from Los Angeles, and here's how I am saving water. I'm relying less on the stream of water when I wash dishes to do the cleaning and relying more on the scrubbing brush. And when I shower, I'm trying as often as possible to do my lathering with the water turned off. Thanks very much.
We've got a shower theme going here for our drought feedback segment. I did not. Sometimes things just come together, Madeline.
But those are good ideas.
We also got another call from Olaf.
I am calling to let you know we removed 4,000 square feet of lawn in our property in Los Angeles and replaced it with all native and related plants, flowering trees, bushes, and ground covers. And we use only 20% of the amount of water we used when we had a lawn. So amazing savings are possible.
80%.
That's great. And
less
I think
water.
You can get some help with that from the DWP.
That's great.
You
want
to do that.
Listen up.
All right.
You can call us 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Leave us a message and you'll hear yourself on the show.
All right. Well, thank you. Jolie Myers, one of our producers, our press players. Have a great weekend. And I'm going to leave you with this little Valentine. We just can't resist. A little bit more of Beyonce on Press Play. Have a great weekend, everyone. Happy Valentine's Day. Warren Olney and To The Point is up next. I'll see you on Monday. Oh, 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 oh.